Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
With the resignations of the Prime Minister and the Home Minister, I expect that they will be able to come out of this particular uprising that's going on and re-establish democratic governance.
22 people are dead after protests and riots in Nepal that has seen the resignation of the Prime Minister and ministers' houses being burnt down, all following a ban on social media. Also coming up on the program...
Unfortunately, it is the case that when you have a young worker,
they're less likely to know of their rights.
Workers, wages and a billion-dollar question. Why are Australia's two major supermarkets caught up in an underpayment scandal? Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, 8 years ago, the Uluru Statement from the Heart called for voice, treaty and truth. Now one of those pillars is taking shape. On September 9, Victoria became the first state to introduce treaty legislation with a bill establishing the First People's Assembly, renamed Gelang Wal, as a permanent authority. Susan Hu asked Dr. Harry Hobbs, Associate Professor in the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales, just what is the role going to be for Gelang Wal?
So the Gelang Wal is going to be established by the Statewide Treaty Act. It's a new body. It's going to be a representative and deliberative body, which is aiming to hold government accountable for its actions and its commitment to supporting First Nations people in the state. What it does is it provides for ongoing truth-telling and healing. It advises the Parliament and the government in relation to matters that affect First Peoples. So if they're going to make laws or policies that affect First Peoples, they're saying that the Gelang Wal, the First Peoples representative body, should be able to speak to Parliament, speak to government, and make those laws and policies better.
How does the treaty aim to address the injustices?
The statewide treaty bill contains a substantial background. Most legislation in Australia doesn't have a background like this. It may have a little preamble that sets out the purpose of the bill, what it's trying to do, and where it's come from. This is really different. It has a really strong background that explains the purpose of the treaty, why we're doing this in Victoria, what treaty is intended to deliver, and really the background, I suppose, of what First Peoples in Victoria hope for it to achieve. As the background to the statewide treaty says, for more than 200 years, First Peoples in the state have been excluded from the design and development of laws and policies that affect them. The central purpose of the statewide treaty is to recognise the rights and status of First Peoples in the state and include them within the policies and processes that make laws in that state and make policies in that state. It's about building an opportunity for First Peoples to be involved in those design discussions, those development discussions, to make laws and policies that affect them better.
We know that this bill is planning to embed First Peoples' history into the education curriculum. How do you think this will affect the long-term and broad support for treaty making?
One of the challenges with modern treaty making in Australia, and indeed Indigenous-state relationships more broadly, is there really is a lot of there's not a lot of awareness about what a treaty is or what a relationship should look like or could look like. That starts with the education curriculum. You see in comparative countries like New Zealand and Canada, they have very strong curriculum, education curriculum that explores the basis of relationships between First Peoples and the state, explains the history of those relationships, the good and the not so good, and talks about a way to build a shared future together. So I think one of the really important aspects of the Victorian treaty process is that it's designed to embed treaty as part of the curriculum, explaining what a treaty is, explaining what a treaty relationship is, and indeed explaining what a relationship based on trust, on mutual respect and equality could look like in contemporary Victoria. My sense is that will help inform and socialise and build greater awareness and perhaps even understanding for the need for treaty relationships in the state.
Victoria deliberately began the treaty process by creating the First Peoples Assembly. Why was it so important to start with representation and co-design rather than jump straight into treaty negotiations?
It was really important to develop suitable architecture and institutions through which negotiations could take place, primarily because the treaty process, even though it is very significant, it still operates within Australian law. So the earliest colonial era treaties between First Nations and powers that arrived in North America or New Zealand, those treaties really were between two or more communities meeting for the first time, trying to develop a way of working together. In Australia, in the modern treaty process, all treaties need to be subject to Australian law. That means First Peoples need to have some sort of understanding and sense of confidence that the treaty will not be just one state, one party imposing its will on the other. It needs to be equitable, it needs to be fair, and the process needs to be clear. So it was really important then to develop those institutions. That included developing a representative body through which First Peoples in the state could work out what they wanted to talk about and work out how they would talk about that. And then using that body, that First Peoples Representative Assembly, to negotiate with the state and develop a clear pathway and a clear process and clear rules of conduct around how negotiations could take place. That has taken a long time. It's taken 10 years to develop all that architecture, but we're here now seeing the benefit of it. The treaty process, I would say, has been a much more structured, staggered process, much more consistent with principles about equality and self-determination than those earliest treaties we've seen, and indeed than some modern treaties in Canada.
Do you think this treaty will put pressure on other states?
I hope so. I think the importance of this treaty shows that it can work. We can develop strong relationships between state and First Nations peoples that are built on principles of equality, mutual respect and self-determination. And indeed, the success of this treaty process, I would say, should put pressure on other states to reconsider their decisions not to push forward treaty processes. It's worth noting that every government around Australia has committed under the National Agreement on Closing the Gap to work with First Nations peoples to develop policies and programs that better their interests and to indeed close the gap in disadvantage. The treaty process is the first one that really works with First Nations peoples to do this effectively and do this together. I think other jurisdictions in Australia should take note.
Dr. Harry Hobbs, Associate Professor in the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales, speaking there with Susan Hu.
Hey there, we're the Warren Miller Band and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Protests in Nepal have erupted following efforts by the government to censor social media communications. Anger at this move snowballed into a wider protest that focused upon government corruption, which has resulted in 22 deaths so far and seen the houses of various ministers burnt down. Stephen Hill asked Dr. Michael Breen of the University of Melbourne whether there are concerns of more violence from the different actors in this civil dispute.
Yeah, I think that's always a concern, and we haven't seen this type of violence erupt in Nepal for quite a number of years. It has to be going back to the time of civil war. But it's not that uncommon for people to take the streets to express their grievances against the government, and there's been a lot of history of that being successful in bringing forward reforms. But at the same time, I think there has been somewhat of a de-escalation on the streets over the last 24 hours. And with the resignations of the Prime Minister and the Home Minister, I expect that they will be able to come out of this particular uprising that's going on and re-establish democratic governance. But there's always that risk that things could get worse.
Tell us a little bit about the generations there that has driven this protest.
Nepali politics has been beset by a lot of self-interested leaders over many decades. The leaders that have been in power have more or less been in power since the 1990s and have taken numerous terms at being prime minister themselves. They were integral in the re-establishment of democracy in the 1990s as well as in the 2000s. Hence, they see themselves as entitled. As the years have gone on, there's been increasing dissatisfaction with corruption and with the lack of development. And we've seen people start to move away from those major political parties. So, for example, the current mayor of Kathmandu is a rapper, so ex-hip-hop star, and he's the first independent to take that rather prestigious position. We also saw a new political party formed by a relatively young television presenter that won a number of seats in the House of Representatives. So it's really quite consistent with the youth essentially giving up on the political leadership of previous generations. They are demanding change, and change hasn't happened, and so they've taken to the streets.
How much of this protest was driven by the plan of the government to censor social media?
In a way that it is a response to the social media ban, but it's pretty apparent that the social media ban is done to stop the spread of allegations of corruption. And it's not the first time that they've done that. They banned Facebook a year or two ago because people were using Facebook to spread information about corrupt politicians. One of the problems recently is the flaunting of wealth by the children of the current political leaders. Theoretically, those children shouldn't have that kind of wealth. Politicians don't earn that much money in Nepal. And so the sharing of that information was one of the things that triggered this uprising.
I've seen successive governments, while they've been democratic, maintained a pretty authoritarian control over many segments of society. There's been a lot of censorship, and politics is riven with factionalism. How difficult it will be to fashion together a consensus in Nepal?
Well, it is extraordinarily difficult to get consensus in Nepal, and so the constitution-making process has aimed towards getting a consensus, and they didn't quite get there. There were some large sectors of society that were left out. The way they do it is they tend to rotate coalitions, and so different parties and different factions will get their turn leading the government and becoming prime minister and the like. I would anticipate that there would be some kind of reformation of a coalition under a different political party, but factionalization has been a real problem. So the prime minister who just resigned and was one faction in that political party, and his factional rival had ended up leaving that political party and started his own political party. And he was recently charged by the Corruption Commission. So that's quite remarkable, because it's a former prime minister being charged with corruption, but also it's somewhat suspicious because it is the factional rival of the then prime minister. So we do see corruption allegations being levelled against rivals. But it's fair to say that corruption is quite widespread across the political sphere. I used to live there some years ago, and we had a schedule of power outages, and we would get sometimes only 4 hours of power per day because there was not enough power being generated. And then a new head of the Electricity Commission came in, and he abolished the corrupt contracts. And all of a sudden, there was 24-hour power in Kathmandu. The extent of corruption in that institution was huge. But at the same time, that put offside a lot of political rivals, and then he ended up being charged with corruption.
At the moment, it looks like the military sort of takes some form of control. And are you confident that there will be a transition back to a civilian government?
I wouldn't say I'm confident, but I am optimistic. So the military isn't particularly autonomous, and it hasn't been used against its own people, even during the civil war. Political parties and then the king were very reluctant to use the army against the then Maoist rebels. As I understand it, less people in the streets. So I think that the military has been able to restore some semblance of order. And then I expect, again, that a new coalition will be formed. But the legitimacy of that new coalition will continue to be questioned by young people until I see some kind of generational change in political leadership.
Dr. Michael Breen from the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne, speaking there with Stephen Hill. You're listening to The Wire, broadcasting all around Australia. And a big hello if you're listening to Edge Radio in Hobart, in 3BB Ballarat, where you can find Radio Gold, or in 8CC in the heart of the nation, Alice Springs. I'm Roderick Chambers. The New South Wales government has pulled back on its plan to remove shark nets off beaches across the state following the death of surfer Mercury Soulakis over the weekend. Despite the decision being of best interest, critics and marine experts have continued to question the effectiveness of shark nets in protecting swimmers alongside their severe environmental impacts. James Bale asked Dr. Vincent Raoul, marine ecologist and shark expert at Griffith University, what were some of the key disadvantages of the shark net.
First of all, there's a common misconception that those shark nets are complete barriers, so that they completely separate swimmers and surfers from sharks. But actually, they're gill nets, so they're fishing nets, and that means they're about 100 meters long, they're a couple of meters high, and they're designed specifically so that animals can swim above and below and around them. So they don't form a complete barrier. And so almost 50% of the sharks that are caught by the shark nets actually were sharks that are heading towards the ocean, so that had already come to the beach and were leaving that area. So they kill a lot of things, very few of which are actually of any threat to people. And in many cases, those that bycatch, those things that are not targeted, those are things that are protected or threatened species. So things like turtles, like dolphins, and even whales. They also kill lots of completely non-threatening other species of shark and other species of ray that are in some cases threatened elsewhere. So, for example, angel sharks are a species of great concern to the shark net, are caught by them. And then finally, I guess the last thing is there's very little evidence to show that those shark nets actually have any effect on reducing the risk of shark bite. We're having this thing where we're using a method which we know has some very serious flaws to reduce shark bite, and at the same time, it has a fairly significant financial as well as an environmental cost. And then finally, we know that despite all this, it's probably not having any major effect on actually increasing beach user safety.
Well, why are sharks attracted to those nets?
There's a lot of people that believe that there's this thing called depredation which is happening, where those nets catch things that the sharks would like to eat. And then the sharks come to the nets specifically because there's essentially bait that's there. Aside from that, those nets are basically a fishing net, and so they're actually designed to not be sensed by the shark and just have the shark kind of amble in and get caught up in those nets.
We have New South Wales. Do you reckon the decision to start removing shark nets along many of the beaches was premature?
It was definitely not premature. There's been a growing public sentiment from local communities that those shark nets need to go. This is done very carefully in parallel with a large education campaign that really outlines what those nets are and what they do and don't do, as well as the environmental and financial costs of those nets, and also the development of a lot of other means of reducing shark bite, like these shark smart listening stations, like the smart drum lines, like drones, like better training for surf lifesavers and those sorts of things. And personal deterrence as well that have a big role to play in this. And I'm pretty sure as well there was no shark net deployed at the beach at the time. So removing the shark net or not would not have any impact on this particular beach anyway.
Does New South Wales laws and procedures around this differentiate from any other states in Australia?
New South Wales has been much more progressive in its attitude towards the shark bite mitigation program than Queensland, for example. And removing the shark nets temporarily is definitely a sign that they are starting to be a lot more progressive compared to Queensland, where Queensland, the shark bite mitigation program is pretty much completely lethal, so that the goal is to kill a whole bunch of sharks and associated animals and the shark nets as well.
With the incident over the weekend in DY, they said that the smart drum lines failed to pick up the shark sighting. Do you still believe a more progressive method like that is the way to go in the future?
Absolutely. The thing that as a society we have to think about is going to be almost impossible to eliminate the risk of shark bite. And as much as this person, you know, dying is an absolute tragedy for his family and the community, we might need to accept that maybe there wasn't a whole lot we could have done to mitigate that effect. You know, we know that culling programs don't work. Had extensive culling programs in Australia now for, you know, 50 years. The shark nets are essentially a culling program. We know they haven't worked overseas. We know that the shark nets and the lethal drum lines just don't actually add that level of safety that people are asking for. And so there are certainly a lot of things that we can do to mitigate shark bite. And looking at ways and behavior and technology to do those things is really important into the future. And so I certainly wouldn't discount the smart drum lines at this stage. It's important to remember that's just one method that we can use to reduce the risk of shark bite. And so no method is certainly going to be a silver bullet.
Dr. Vincent Raoul of Griffith University speaking there with James Bale.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio right across Australia. Stay well.
The federal court has delivered a judgment to supermarket giants Coles and Woolworths for allegedly underpaying up to 30,000 staff over several years. This could see them repaying over $1 billion. The dispute has primarily been centred on what is known as set-off arrangements within employment contracts. Maeve Groom asked Tom Dillon, Research Fellow at the Centre for Employment and Labour Relations Law at the University of Melbourne, how these arrangements could have impacted employees' pay entitlements.
Set-off arrangements, they've become very common in modern Australian industrial relations. The central idea of a set-off arrangement is pretty much that a worker who might be entitled or who is entitled to, say, penalty rates or overtime pay, they receive a higher base rate of pay, like higher hourly, and that's meant to sort of offset some of the penalty rates. So say, for example, if an award rate has a minimum of $25, an employer will pay $30 per hour, and then any overtime rates, penalty rates, things like that, that the employee earns, they will be set off against the higher base rate of pay.
And in terms of this arrangement, how does this affect things like job security, annual leave, sick pay, and any other aspects like that?
Yeah, so in theory, set-off arrangements don't have to affect those things and don't have to be detrimental to employees. In practice, there's a few issues. One is that a lot of the time, the employees who are bound to or who do agree to set-off arrangements are casual employees. So a lot of the time, they won't even necessarily have any job security, annual leave or sick pay. And another issue, as has kind of become in these proceedings, is that there's difficulty with identifying the exact entitlements that an employee might have earned, the exact hours they've worked and things like that.
The two companies were also found in the ruling to not have complied with obligations in keeping accurate employment records. What does this mean exactly? Is it a rostering or timesheet issue, or more of a shift to that casualisation of staff and shifts?
Yeah, so in effect, the Fair Work regulations, which form part of the Fair Work Act, more or less, they oblige employers to hold a number of records. So, for example, some of those records will be records of employees' overtime, and their penalty rates, things like that. The onus is on the employer to keep those records. And in proceedings that are brought under the Fair Work Act, where it's alleged that, as was the case, that an employer has not kept a record, it's on the employer to show that they have kept the records and that they're accurate. As was borne out in the case, not enough for employees to just rely on employees filling out their timesheets and then using that as definitive proof of an accurate record of hours. They have to do something more, as was shown. And as was the case with some of the supermarket employees, they were working above the hours that some of the timesheets recorded.
And obviously we know many teenagers and young people make up the workforce of supermarkets like Coles and Woolies. Do you think these workers are more vulnerable to being underpaid or exploited because they may not know their workplace rights or understand their contract?
Unfortunately, I absolutely do think that's the case. I had the opportunity to be part of some research which surveyed thousands of young workers in situations like this and canvassed their experiences of exploitation. Unfortunately, it is the case that when you have a young worker, they're less likely to know of their rights. In a practical sense also, a 16, 17, 18-year-old is going to have more difficulty confronting their boss or their supervisor to try to enforce their rights. So unfortunately, that leads to a circle where a very vulnerable class of workers become vulnerable.
My final question would be, could this ruling set a precedent for other industries beyond retail or supermarkets?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it has the potential to do that. Some of the findings by Justice Perham certainly aren't isolated to just the retail and supermarket industry. Some of the findings are to the effect that employers' record keeping and their use of set-off arrangements has to be done carefully and diligently, and employers can't just rely on things like set-off arrangements together with timesheets to prove that employees worked and only worked the hours recorded on those sheets.
Tom Dillon, Research Fellow at the Centre for Employment and Labour Relations Law at the University of Melbourne, speaking there with Maeve Groom. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.